From high above South First Street in online exclusive Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk gaming and game development. I'm Ellen Burns Johnson, and I make nice games.
I'm Stephen McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Arthur Croy. I too make nice games.
This week, your nice hosts recap the online-only GDC 2021. We'll talk about what GDC has become in its second pandemic year and recap a few of the more interesting talks from the conference. And so, if everyone is ready, let's start.
Everybody ready for this GDC recap? Everyone here at the table, all set, got everything you need,
yep.
Reviewed all the... Steven, you're good?
Yep.
Ellen, you're good?
My dog ate it.
Okay.
Which one?
Yes. both dogs ate it.
Fair.
No, I meant to do it, and then I gave myself too many other things to do.
Yeah.
And I didn't do it. But I did have a question about that before we get started on, you know, the useful and valuable things that you guys brought to talk about today.
We'll get there. Don't worry about it.
This is a valuable question. So much so that we might even revisit it at the end of the episode.
Ooh.
Yeah, Mark.
Okay.
Should have seen the face that he just made at me. Okay, so GDC puts up some other conference talks on their YouTube channel.
Yes.
How many months / years after a conference will they put some of the videos from that conference up on the channel?
I don't know.
I thought it was a year.
I think it used to be understood that it was that last year's talks would show up around this time or whatever. That might be true, but also sometimes it would be like a month after, like a high profile. It feels kind of random to the point where if there is a standard pattern, I don't know what it is because it's hard to deduce it. Because there are ultimately there are so many talks and a lot of them do appear on YouTube for free at some point. And that's kind of the thing that when we do our GDC recaps every year, it's kind of knowing that like you can't really look at the video yourself, at least not right now.
Yeah.
But a lot of them do end up, and I think more and more of them do, which, I mean, GDC is rightly criticized for being way too expensive for what it offers.
Yeah.
And it doesn't pay speakers. And it's like there's lots of problems with it. And I think we talk about that every year. It should be recapped every year. It's kind of a boring perennial topic, frankly. But it's important not to forget it. But they have done a good job of putting out tons of those talks for free eventually. And a lot of them are timeless. So I have to give them a little bit of credit, even though it's kind of through clenched teeth, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
Ellen, like when you were saying, you know, you didn't get around to watching a couple of the talks that you wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of interesting because of the way GDC is this year. Like we didn't go to GDC,
right?
So like it's actually, and I've talked to a bunch of other people about this. Like you take a week off from work, or you take a week off from all your responsibilities to go to San Francisco,
right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was thinking about that. Like I didn't realize that GDC was happening.
Yeah.
Until I don't know, people brought it up on like random Discords and stuff, and it didn't feel like it was a thing, because I guess in the past when GDC was happening, like people would be out of town and you wouldn't see somebody for a week, and then they come back and say, oh, I did all this stuff at GDC. This year it was just some people watched talks, I guess.
Yeah.
And it didn't feel like an event.
And a lot of people didn't take the time off because you could just do it at night. You could do it, you know, you could recap, because all the talks, they're all pre-recorded.
Yeah.
And then they become immediately video on demand the moment they're done. And so there's a schedule, but who cares?
Right.
You know,
right.
There wasn't Q&A. There was like speakers were encouraged to be there at their appointed time to like chat in the chat log to sort of simulate some of the Q&A at a live event. But all the talks were pre-recorded. And then that's how I watched them, is all after the fact.
Yeah.
But it didn't occur to me for even a second to take time off of my other responsibilities to participate. Partly because it just felt like so convenient to not have to.
Yeah.
But I've talked to a couple of people who just very, very few people who said, I did that and it was worth it. And I was like, okay, I guess. But I mean, especially if you bought a pass yourself, then that's the time,
right.
Because you're invested, right? Mm-hmm. We went to GDC on a press badge this year.
Yeah.
So partly we didn't have a lot of motive, like we didn't have a lot of skin in the game to really make it worth our dollars, which is usually how it works. So we're very fortunate in that sense that we had that access. Hopefully we're paying that forward a little bit by providing you with some content by talking about some of these things.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just easy to I watched three for this purpose of review, but I only have watched five or six total. Mm-hmm. I have a huge list of things I have to get to. So I definitely, Ellen, same thing, just at a different scale. Like I really thought I would have participated in a lot more of it this year than I actually did.
Yeah.
And I kind of, you know, now I have to remember not to forget to, you know, actually go back and watch them. Like every year I always tell myself, I'm going to watch those talks later. And then I usually don't.
There's always something more to do. Well, yeah. Same thing happened. I mean, I have a terrible track record when it comes to attending, quote unquote, online conferences. Yep. Like, listeners will remember from just a month or so ago, I had the Serious Play conference and I didn't attend a lot of that either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you had responsibilities at that conference.
I did. Yeah. I was doing video editing and volunteering in that regard. So there was like a little bit other stuff taking up my time.
Yeah.
But in the week since, I have it on my whiteboard with a sticky note, like watch these videos mm-hmm. and they are all out now. So I can watch them at any point and I just haven't gotten around to it. Now I have even more videos to catch up on yeah. with GDC. So yeah, I understand. Mm-hmm. I understand. And my dog ate it.
Right.
Also that, yes.
You know? So this is the second year that GDC has been online only.
Yeah.
It's actually the third GDC conference of a sort
yeah.
since the pandemic started. They did GDC Summer. We talked about it on the show. I don't know how much. It's sort of like, who cares now? But like, there was a lot of like, it was postponed and then it was it postponed indefinitely, then it was rescheduled and it was rescheduled again.
Yep.
And then it was like, okay, we're not going to do full GDC. We're going to do GDC Summer, which is a separate thing.
Yeah.
We're still doing GDC for real in the fall. And then GDC Summer was everyone put their energy. Mm. It was a smaller event, online only. And then they did do GDC in the fall as an online only event. And I don't remember even how we covered it, but like it kind of just went by.
I literally don't even remember this happening.
Yeah. And of course, and now it's, you know, we're midsummer now.
Yeah.
But like GDC normally happens in March. And like, it's not just the pandemic. It's like everything about GDC has been like kicked off its cadence in a way that's very strange. And so presumably, I mean, fingers crossed, we'll be in a position where we can do an in-person conference of that scale next March. You know, we'll do another pandemic update, but like, I'm not going to guarantee, I think we all would like to assume that's going to happen.
Yeah.
But we can't guarantee that that's going to be a fully safe at that scale anyway.
Yeah.
Especially as an international event.
Yeah.
In any case, assuming that there is a GDC in March of 2022, what's it going to look like? Like an in-person, like they did so much stuff to make the online version better in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But it missed a lot of stuff. But like, can you pre-record talks? Can you get talks from more diverse speakers from around the world who don't need to travel? Especially because you're not paying them, so it locks off a lot of knowledge that you can't bring to the show.
Right.
That a lot of those people were able to participate at these last two events.
Yeah.
When it goes back in person, is it going to be a hybrid? How is that going to work?
Yeah.
That is a very good question. I don't know. I think a lot of people are. I mean, we're doing that now. We're thinking about.
Yeah, literally our podcast is
going to work. Well, it's true. Yeah, at our scale, it's like how are we going to do? You know, we've done a lot of interviews from people all over the world this past year. How are we going to keep that going now that we can't tear ourselves away from this table now that we're back in person?
Yeah,
and also our local community events, our IDGA chapter, we do online events, and we've had a lot of advantages doing online. What are we going to do when we do go back in person? When's that going to be? Blah 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 blah. Yeah. But like GDC is that, but just times a million, and like. It will be such a shame to miss out on the stuff they get. But also the stuff on that in-person stuff, like as much as I criticize it, like I always tell people, go to GDC once. It's too expensive and you're going to regret a lot about it, but you got
to
go once.
There's a lot of benefits to GDC that aren't possible. There aren't really natural, I guess. And I say possible. Maybe that's not completely accurate as an online conference.
Yeah.
Cause a lot of like GDC stuff happens because people run into each other. Then they have conversations. Those conversations lead to other conversations. And pretty soon you're making a game and you didn't even realize that was happening. You know, like that
the
kind
talks
of stuff.
Are just mm-hmm. a component.
And a lot of people use GDC for that purpose, for networking mm-hmm. and such. And you can kind of do that on GDC online, but it's not
the same.
It's not nearly the same. I don't think it's
they had
beneficial.
Like on they had some like sort of networking chat rooms that were sort of like Discord rooms.
Yeah.
And I didn't do any of those, but the people I've talked to who had said like, it's okay.
Yeah,
like it's like I have a good time, but mm-hmm. you know, it's not quite the same thing.
Yeah,
and I think part of it is like you know, I think we've talked in recent years about like you know GDC parties and how that's being reformed. Mm-hmm. It's a slow process. Mm-hmm. I wonder if this like 2 year pause will actually either halt or speed up that evolution. I'd hate that everyone is like, oh, we're finally back in person. Let's bring out the drinks. You know what I mean? Well, I hope that's not it.
I'm not even talking about like parties. I'm just talking about like just walking between conferences.
Right, right. Well, that's what I'm getting at is that so much of GDC happens outside the conference.
Exactly.
Tons and tons of people go to San Francisco every March and do not buy a pass.
Yeah.
And for the first couple of years I went, I was like, that's crazy because there's such this, it's so valuable, this conference, because I'm very much, I want to sit in the lecture hall and hear the lectures.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I know Martha and I bonded over that. Like, we just love talks.
Yeah.
But that's not what the true value of GDC is, which is sort of a weird shame because the tickets are so expensive. But if you figure that out, then you can just go stay to Airbnb, spend as little money as possible, and book a ton of meetings.
Yep.
That's a really good experience.
Exactly.
And you can't quite have that online
form. Yeah. 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 So that's like an aspect that, even if it was like some kind of a hybrid thing where like they did some online things, some offline things, the people who would do the online talks would still not be able to run into people, in San Francisco. They'd do their their talk on a theater screen or whatever, and then like that would be it.
Yeah.
Or it'd be pre-recorded, and then they'd barely have any interaction with GDC other than, you know, sending them the video. So like there's a lot of that content that you will just miss. You know, not being in person.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess what I'm saying is I don't know. I'm sure that they're trying to get back into an in person event because, well, first off, they can charge more money for it, but also
not a lot more money.
Well,
the tickets were very, very expensive.
Oh no, they were not cheap before. They were not cheap during online, but they're still expensive.
Yeah.
Either way, but also I think that a lot of people value that, and I think that is a lot of the importance of GDC to a lot of developers and companies who are sponsoring and such.
Mm-hmm.
So they're probably going to push for a lot more in-person stuff, and ideally they would do more hybrid stuff and allow more diverse speakers, people from all over the world, to have conversations and stuff and have talks during GDC. But I pessimistically am not anticipating a lot.
Yeah, it's hard to move an aircraft carrier, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
like and they had to pivot, but it was really just a detour. Like,
yes.
Maybe when they get back, they'll have all their old. And I don't blame them in a sense. Like, it's been humming for years. Like, I hope there's a lot of energy in that organization to like apply the learnings from the past year and not just because I think it might have just been like a separate team that handled this because it's such a different experience.
Possibly.
So yeah, fingers crossed. But I also do not have a lot of confidence. We'll start off with mine. The first one I watched was the Indie Soapbox. So every year GDC, it's a bunch of micro talks that are done at the Independent Games Summit, which is the programming block of GDC that is for independent games.
Yeah.
The summits at GDC are themed and they're scheduled by specific groups panels for those. But the Indie Soapbox is great because it's these short 2 to 5 minute talks, a bunch of them. That are just some of them are a little bit off kilter, and they're really about like just ranting about something a lot of times.
Yeah.
And so they have a lot of variety, and they're always fun to. So every year I always make sure I see that. And so this year there's a couple of the micro talks within that I want to talk about. One of them is called Representation Matters. Sean Alexander Allen did that one. He's a organizer.
I know him.
Yeah, he's an organizer for Game Devs of Color Expo, and he talked about representation, and he kind of wanted to say, like, at the beginning, he was like, yeah, I know you've heard this before, but it's kind of different the way I want to talk about it.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I think the points I want to touch on that was really, really interesting to me was this impression of success. And I think this is really, really important because especially when it comes to making sure that there is a viable career path for unrepresented groups.
Yeah.
That a lot of times we see a lot of press, a lot of retweets and attention given to projects for marginalized developers, and we think, oh, that was a big hit in the world, right, in the marketplace of ideas.
Yeah.
So they're doing good. These organizations that are promoting these, that are trying to foster these sort of making sure that attention goes to more diverse places.
Mm-hmm.
It's working. And then you realize like, no, gamers didn't actually buy that game.
Right.
And then like, so what good is it?
Yeah,
and also, I think we tend to be very secretive about our own financials. This isn't just like sharing salaries, but like indie developers, they put out a game and it got some attention and it didn't sell well. They don't want to tell people that. They want to like, I'm a hit indie developer. You saw my feature in Kotaku. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
But like, so he sort of makes the point that what we see as progress, it's so surface level. We don't actually know.
That's I don't know if he goes into the that conversation or the conversation I'm about to bring up, I guess. But mm-hmm. like another thing that I think about with respect to that is how like more games nowadays feature people of color, you know, as like the main protagonist and stuff. Yep. And a lot of people will want to support games that have that, but like oftentimes those games are still built by not underrepresented communities.
Yes, he did talk about that.
Okay, yeah. So sure. like that is still an aspect. That is something like people will see that and go, oh yes, we're finding, you know, we're breaking barriers. There's some success in that. But behind the scenes, you don't see all that. And you don't see
yes
that it's not. It hasn't gotten more diverse.
Right, right. So, it's like, you know, it's like we had a black president, and that that doesn't actually mean that much. It's symbolic, and the symbol is important.
Right.
Or like, you know, Will Smith is a movie star,
yeah.
like since the 90s. So it's like, well, how could this country be racist? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
there's a lot of like, there's that, and we talk about it all the time, the difference between like representation in content versus in production.
Yes.
And I think even when you know that, it's really easy to kind of see like, oh, you know, that game Deathloop's coming out. It's got two people of color as its protagonist.
Yes.
That's real progress. But like, is it? Like, I mean, it is in a sense, right? It is real.
Yeah,
but like it, you know, how hard should we be clapping for each of these individual successes?
Yep.
You
that
know?
Being said, I'm going to buy that game.
Yeah. It just looks ace. It's looks just, a great game. Yeah,
it's not the whole story. Exactly. Right, exactly. It's not the whole story.
Yes,
and yeah. but it's easy to react as if it is, you know.
Yeah, and I thought he just made it. He really laid it out pretty well in a way that wasn't so dire, but also it was pretty, you know, like forceful. Like this is. Like,
oh, yeah.
There's still work to do, Sean, right?
Yeah.
He's wonderful.
So one of the other ones in the indie soapbox was a really good one. It was very called "Don't Say Indie Game," like quote indie game.
Okay,
just really like the main point of this one that I really liked was this idea of like we think of indie as a type of game, mm-hmm. but we should be thinking about it as a type of developer. And I don't think that's. I think a lot of people do think of it that way. I don't think it's the most novel idea. But there's like, what's an indie game? Is an indie game a game without a publisher? Is it a game that only costs this much to make? Is it a game that only costs $10?
Sure.
What is an indie game? And his position is like, let's just stop using it entirely. Like, let's just talk about indie game developers are game developers who are indie, not developers who make indie games.
Sure.
Right?
Okay. I see that.
And I just liked that. It was kind of a simple thesis.
I guess when I think of an indie game, I think of an auteur.
Okay, you're talking about content then. See, that's another confusing element, right? When you think of an art house film, you're like, oh, it was put out by A24, which is like a multi-million dollar corporation.
Yeah.
You know, or like Fox Searchlight, the bespoke artist brand of 20th Century Fox.
Right.
Like, you think of those as art house films. It's like, really? Like, well, I guess yes. It's helpful to have these labels, even if they're not, they're accurate only in a sense.
Yep.
An indie game has become that very much so.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, and so that's what I see it. Like, when I... like games on itch. Including Vengeance. You can get that now for free.
Yeah.
But you should pay some.
Yeah. But you know, I mean, to the definition, sometimes like there are lots of indie games that have simple arcade style mechanics that are made by small teams, but don't feel indie because they don't have that kind of sense of sort of grandeur and, you know, artisanal blah blah blah, right?
Or quirkiness. Quirkiness comes to mind too.
Right. Yeah. Quirkiness is a good sort of style or whatever. Yeah.
Yep.
So how would that come out in speech? You'd say, "Oh yeah, I'm an indie game developer. I'm an indie game developer."
There you go. That's the difference.
Indie game developer. Indie game developer.
Yeah. And you know, all these definitions. I liked that as a focus.
Sure.
Like, I think I probably already thought that way, but I just like how stark that was put. It's just like, don't say indie game anymore. I mean, you know, I'm not going to sign on and say like everyone should adopt that philosophy, but I think it's a really good thing to consider when you think about how we categorize this everything.
Yeah.
So I like that a lot. The other one in this group that I really liked was about building developer communities, and we're facing this right now in the Minneapolis area because we're sort of rebuilding after the pandemic.
Yeah.
The IDGA chapter is sort of trying to do this with events. And I haven't talked about this at all in the show, but I'm looking to have a space that we can have for developers to do their work and to hold events and stuff. And when that becomes, you know, moves along, we'll talk more about it on the show. But so this really hit me. Rachel Salla talked about Glitch City LA, which is a you know, has an interesting model of funding. It's sort of an artist collective. Not that uncommon. We used to have that here. You know, Toronto's Hand Eye Society or Seattle Indies, or there's a couple of places. A developer I'm working with, you know, opened up a space in Olympia that's very similar. It's kind of an idea just to have, like, a lot of us are, you know, 1 to 3 person teams working from home.
Yep.
And, you know, can we find a place to work together and also hold events together, you know, find a way to force multiply ourselves in terms of, like, you know, our sales potentials, like we hold playtest events, or we hold, like, preview events, or we do, you know, art shows and galleries and stuff like that. And Glitch City LA has been around for almost a decade, and like they've grown in a really sustainable way. And I just really admire the sort of, like, I don't know, I look at them with, like, a sort of admiration and jealousy of, like, that what they've been able to do and sort of keep their scale sensible.
They're in LA.
Well, true.
They have, like, a big community, so, like, they can get a lot of people together pretty quick. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I don't know if I want to put enough of
But, yeah, I don't want to say that they didn't work at it. I've heard Glitch. It's great, but I'm just saying.
No, right, for sure.
It's harder for us.
There's a difference. As a Midwest city of smaller size, absolutely. There's a different challenge that we have.
Don't compare Minnesota apples to California oranges.
Yes.
But I just really liked it. One of the things she said was, like, before we started this, I thought I was the only game developer in Los Angeles. And I'm like, a lot of us have had that feeling before we found a community.
Yeah.
And I imagine a lot of our listeners who have their own communities, either online or in person, also felt that way at some point in time.
Yeah.
But I feel like I'm the only one around here who is into this.
Dang. Okay. Ignore what I said before.
But that's what it is. It's like, it's you really have no idea. And the thing is even a mid-sized metropolis like Minneapolis has so many people. Of course, like, we're gonna have a critical mass of people interested in this, and so I think it's and then as you build that community, you learn what its limits really are, how big it really is, including the people who haven't joined in yet. Anyway, just the way that she presented that is sort of like a kind of a little summary of their history and how they adapted to the pandemic, which is something we've had to do here in our community as well, and the slow march back to, you know, back to reality, to call it something. And and like we're talking about with GDC, what lessons you take with you, and what can you bring, and what you hope not to lose, the learnings that you had. So that was, I enjoyed that little talk.
Cool.
All right. So that was Indie Soapbox. There was other talks in there. I just wanted to highlight those three. Another talk I want to talk about is a friend of the show, August Brown, who's been on the show. He's local to Minneapolis. He is the a producer at Armor Games. He was formerly at Kongregate, and at that, when he was with them, he came on the show to talk about publisher-developer relations.
Yes.
And we loved that episode so much that I think we re-aired it during one of our repeat blocks.
Yeah.
And he did a talk called Demystifying Indie Publishing Offers. And what I loved about it is, one, August is just a font of knowledge. Like, he's he's brilliant, he's smart, he's clever, he's funny, he's, like, an enjoyable person, he's great to be around. You know, we're pro August Brown here on the show. but also, he prefaced this talk with a really interesting thing that I thought was so key, which was this slide. He said, it was like, why would you listen to me? Right. Which is a pretty common thing. You say, these are my qualifications. This is why I might be someone to listen to. But then he followed that up with, why should you be skeptical of me?
I like that.
And he, you know, and he laid it out. He's like, I've never worked for I've never worked on the dev side. I've only worked for publishers. Like, I have my own views. And, you know, and I'm not going to be able to give it. He was very, it was just this, like, it really, almost a third of the talk was disclaimer before he really got to the meat of it.
Yeah.
But what was interesting about it, it was so, that alone was a lot of interesting education.
Yeah.
And then the rest of the talk was just the stuff every developer needs to hear about a publishing contract, about where are the red flags? What are the core components of it? This is a learnings that I went through a couple of years ago when we were, you know, pitching out Widget Satchel, and really helped me when we signed it to WorkerBee in Japan. Mm-hmm. And going through the way he lays it out is like, oh, he's doing it in such a great way. So I really hope that talk ends up on the YouTube channel for people to see, because it was really, really good. But one of the things that also in this talk that was just fun was that every slide had a picture of a cute dog on it. So
he's like,
you know, you want to be making your game. You want to be doing your fun stuff. This is boring. Mm-hmm. So he didn't acknowledge it in this talk. It's just every slide, a majority of it was a photo of a dog, which is very cute. So it was a fun watch, I think, is the other thing about it. And one of the things he says in it is just about the power dynamics. He's like, listen, the truth is your power dynamics are always going to favor the publisher because a developer, that's why you want to field multiple offers, right? You want to, you don't want to get the first offer you get. You want to get as many offers as possible so you have some leverage and so you have some choice. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But also he's very clear about you're not going to get everything you want. And also the publisher should not get everything they want.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so I think he just really laid it out in a way that hopefully developers will have the confidence to understand that relationship. And I think, and I know that's the way he works with developers, is to make sure that they know they have power to negotiate and like being very upfront and honest about that. And I admire him for trying to spread that as a way to run a publishing arm, right? Yeah. The one thing that I want to follow up with him personally about this, because I hear this all the time in a lot of topics that get hairy, like when it comes to contracts, and I'm dealing with this now in another area, is the advice like, get a lawyer. You need a lawyer. Get a lawyer. You need to get a lawyer. It makes sense to you. We got to get a lawyer. Got to get a lawyer. And I think that August said that repeatedly because he said that's the main thing is like, it's important to know all this stuff. It's important to know how it works, but you need a lawyer to look at it.
Yeah.
And I think that's absolutely right. And that, but the thing that I want to ask him about is, I've heard that advice all the time. Is like, how do you do that?
How
like,
do you call up
like, hello, 1-800 lawyers? I need one.
I need one for my game.
But you know, it's difficult because you know, you imagine you have to pay for it. But like, what services are you asking for?
Yeah, because there are different types of lawyers.
Yeah, not just, are you? It's like I need you on retainer until this negotiation is done. Yeah. I want to pay you for 3 hours of your time to review this contract.
Yeah,
what is that? And I think that's outside the scope of what August's talk was.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's the one piece of like this is I feel there's a lot of times with the knowledge you get, and unless you really immerse yourself and go deep and pull back all the layers of this stuff. Sometimes you'll get this, here's how it works. And you're like, great, I don't actually know what to do now.
Yeah.
And I think that was one where I sort of was like, oh, that's the next thing we need. There's some like there's lots of legal talks at GDC, a couple of really good ones. But I would love here's how you open up the phone book.
Right.
And call up like, and yeah, call and like they're and
help you look over this.
And
document.
You know, the legal profession is varied, right? You're not gonna talk to a real estate lawyer. You want to talk to an entertainment lawyer, but you know. Like, how do you find that? And, you know, in your area, or does it need to be in your area? Do you need to meet in person? Like, what's the communication like?
Yeah.
Do you email back and forth? What are the deliverables you'd ask from them if you're hiring them to help you with a contract? Are they going to rewrite it for you so you can send it, you know, as a negotiation?
Yeah.
Are they going to give you notes? Like, how would all that process, I'm desperate for that talk. I ask August about like what he tells people that first step is, because it's way outside the scope for him to be able to offer all that information.
Yeah.
But that, I just was thinking about that every time he said that. It was like, oh, that's one of those untapped areas that I can't wait for someone to uncover.
Well, I added it to our backlog of topics.
maybe we will be the ones who provide the information. Dang, we should. All right.
Well, you can. I don't know anything about lawyers.
I only know a little bit. That's not helpful.
It's more than me.
That's outside the scope of this episode.
That's true.
Fair.
Okay, so the last one that I want to talk about is called How to Avoid an Identity Crisis as a Technical Designer.
Love that title.
Yeah, and this was a moderated panel hosted by John Art Diaz, a AAA technical designer. And the whole panel was AAA technical designers.
Oh,
now,
sure.
What is a technical designer was a big part of this talk because it's kind of a newer field. And so a lot of it was describing the role and also each of the panelists describing how it was different for their companies. So I'm like, oh, I'm trying to start up a department, or I started as this, but then once I realized this was a thing, I asked to get my title changed. And then we started building this department at our company. And the reason it sort of hit me is because when we were doing the Ludum Dare game jam a couple months ago, when Johnny and I were working together on the code, he just said like, hey, you know, you're a technical designer. And I'm like, what's that? and so that stuck with me because I've always had and I think I've talked about this before, I've had a difficulty defining myself.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of indie developers do. Like, we're generalists. We do a lot of stuff. Like I write music and I also do code and I also write scripts. And it's like, well, you really can't put on a business card, I do everything, I'm the best. Like, that's such a, I mean, one, it's not true, you know.
Right.
But also, it's really hard to sell yourself. And so that's why I've never really considered myself, I've never been that interested in like applying for jobs, because what job do I want, right? Sure. And so that's always been a difficult part for my game dev career. I've always considered myself, well, I'm just going to make my own games. That was always my first thought. It wasn't until recently that I considered anything other than that. Mm-hmm. And but to hear this defined, it actually does fit me pretty well, at least where I would fit on a larger team.
Can you define that again?
Yes. So the way they describe it is sort of it comes out of a generalist becomes a technical designer is kind of how they say, like,
okay.
And basically it's like the glue that holds all the departments together. So like technically minded designers is kind of what they say. So okay. The way, at least in AAA, and a lot of these developers talked about, is generally it's a support role. So mm-hmm. You're sort of you're the liaison between design and programming.
Yeah.
And so a lot of times it's like a designer has this system.
Yep.
A programmer has these libraries, and like this, and like a technical designer says like, well, this is how you will build that. And here's my technical design document.
Yeah.
To take all of these things, like, oh, we need a system where the character does this when this happens.
Yeah.
And then you say, well, okay, this is literally how we're going to do it, because that's not a designer's job.
Right.
Necessarily, yeah. is to tell the engineers literally how to do it.
Yeah.
And frequently it was the engineer's job to come up with how to do it. And that would, and so there, but there was no translation layer. And so that's what a technical designer does, okay. At least in the AAA space. So one of the things that I bristled against a little bit is partly because, like, I do sometimes see myself as an auteur. Like, I want to be, you know, I want to be the idea person,
yeah.
But I also do want to write, you know, the code that turns a byte array into an integer, whatever. Yeah. Like, I do want to do that. But hearing them talk about it as a support role, they say, like, listen, the important thing is to know is, like, if you want to do this, you need to have a lot of skills in other ways. You need to be able to pick up parts of the production that no one else is doing, so that it can be the bridge between two departments that aren't talking to each other enough. Mm. And I find I'm like, oh, that I love doing that. When I was working in film and video, when I was working in advertising, like I loved being the contact point between copywriters and art directors because I knew a little bit about both. And
yeah.
So that felt very satisfying to me. Yeah. And I didn't care that I wasn't the one coming up with either, you know, the top down part. Like, that never bothered me in that part of my professional life.
Yeah.
But I making games, I maybe have a little bit more investment in. So part of me was like, oh, that's kind of a shame. But like, you know, like people with a lot of talent and drive and have that kind of holistic sense that I always value in the work that I do, their best place at a AAA studio is to be behind the curtain as the glue holding it all together. And that is so you're going to have to you have to be comfortable with that and have satisfaction for providing tools and systems that assist. And you can then, you know, a big part of the project becomes, you know, yours.
Yeah.
But not in the same way that it is for other people.
I don't know. I mean, like, it makes sense. That makes sense to me that you'd have that reaction.
Yeah.
But also having seen so many smaller projects just completely fall apart because of breakdowns in communication between design and development.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, that if that role is needed, there is no substitute for someone who can cross pollinate like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And there being a support role is actually kind of vital to it working.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. Because you want somebody who is sort of a neutral player in a sense,
mm-hmm.
right? They want to, and so this is a relationship I always had with clients in the old days where they wanted to do something. It was their idea. They didn't know how to do it, right? And I knew how to do it. So my job was to deliver their idea. And there's a lot of creativity in that. There's a lot of satisfaction you can get from it.
Yeah.
But I don't, in games, I've hearing that, I'm like, oh, that's me. That's totally me.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm like, I don't want to do that in games necessarily.
You don't want to have it be your full-time job necessarily. Yeah.
It was kind of like at a moment, I'm like, oh my God, I could put that on my business card. It's exactly what I am.
Oh.
And then part of me is like, oh, but you know what? That actually isn't what I want.
Right.
Sure. Okay. That makes a lot of sense. Now I understand.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it was very enlightening. And I think, I do think a lot of, if you do find yourself on a small indie team, having that satisfaction of being that glue, it is a thrill, right? To be that connective tissue. Like,
yeah.
I get a lot of thrill out of it personally. If that's you, and you know, you can go far. This is a new field. It you become incredibly valuable. Like, in fact, one of the pitfalls that they described in this talk was you become indispensable because you're the only one who knows the various ins and outs of all these different things.
Yeah.
And so documentation, mm-hmm. training, making sure that you have juniors that you can assign and that you can have a continuity, that's so important to avoid burnout, because technical designers suffer from burnout more than other types of designers. Mm-hmm. To at least way they describe it, to an order of magnitude. Oh. And I'm like, I could totally see how that would happen.
That's super interesting. One of the things that that came to mind, I promised I was going to give you some tough questions.
Uh-huh.
And I'm going to, while I'm vamping here, I'm going to come up with the words to go with my idea, and I'm going to make those words into a tough question for you, Mark. But I was just thinking, like, oh gosh, how would my husband, Eric, the Scrum Master,
mm-hmm.
react to this role? Because to me, it seems very anti-agile. Like, it's creating a silo where you don't want silos, right? And instead of actually solving the problem, which is design and development not communicating well, mm-hmm. maybe because you don't have good cross-functional teams, we are inventing another role that is taking on this the role of communicator.
Yeah.
But then you're investing a whole bunch of effort and skill into this one person, and you're making the project overall vulnerable to that person's burnout and leaving.
So I don't know. I do have a response to that, which is and this is part of what from this talk, but this is also a little bit of me applying sort of my knowledge and experience, which is that one of the things that generalists tend to get frustrated by is that phrase, jack of all trades, master of none, right? And if you are the glue that holds everything together, and then you become that the communicative liaison, you can be a jack of all trades, right? Because you can know a little bit about what they do, a little bit of what they do, and make sure that they are in sync or whatever. Mm-hmm. But a tentacle designer actually does the work too, right?
Okay.
And so and what that means is being able to know a little bit about this and a little bit about that is a new skill nobody else has. And so a designer should not need to know how to write a class. Like, they shouldn't have, I mean, it's a good idea, I guess, but like, they didn't have to, right? It's not part of their job description, you know? And a programmer shouldn't necessarily need to worry about the design implications of some of the stuff that they're building, right? Yeah. I think ideally personally, I feel like everyone should know a little bit about everything. Like, I kind of want everyone to be this a bit.
Yeah.
But in a highly structured, multiple, you know, many person organization, an efficient system, that communication isn't always about talking in a meeting, making sure you know what the other one wants. It's about someone who literally understands what they're both saying and actually able to do some implementation. And I think that is a way, that's one of those things that, like, if you do feel that kind of frustration of not being an expert in one topic, or not being gone to as an expert in one topic and being seen as a jack of all trades, a tentacle designer is that role is a way for you to sort of prove how uniquely qualified you are in some of those cases. And so that, I'm not sure if that fully answers your question or solves that dilemma.
I don't think that Ellen asked the question yet.
I didn't technically ask a question.
Okay.
But there was maybe a question implied,
which is
it a good idea?
Yeah, well, there you go.
Yep. For sure. Because it could be just basically like, well, is it just spackle in an organization?
Yeah, that's really.
And I think and it's an evolving field, right? Mm-hmm. But I would like to think, because I've talked to designers who like I'm like, you think differently if you knew how these things are built.
Yeah.
And it would waste less of your time. And I've talked to engineers who I'm like, you would think differently if you knew how games were designed. Like, and it's neither their fault necessarily, right? It's like not necessarily incumbent upon them to be an expert in the other thing because they have lives to lead.
Well, yeah, exactly. Right. And you're involved in something that's so complex on its own that you don't have the time to be expert in two things.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean that you shouldn't maybe endeavor to be a little bit T-shaped. It sounds like the technical designer is the expert at being T-shaped.
A little bit, yeah. And you know, some of it's like, well, is this just everyone like saying things to feel good about themselves? Like the situation that exists, adapt, you know. But this, again, another talk I do hope ends up on the YouTube channel, because I think it was very clarifying for me. Because I've had a difficult time explaining some of those things about like why it is kind of important to be multidisciplinary.
Yeah.
Independent of like what you actually want to do. Like, you should know about other stuff. And it's like, well, if there's a role for that, then it's really just about a project being multidisciplinary. Yeah. You know, and a way to actually have those connections. And not necessarily every person has to be. Because it's also a lot to ask of any one person. Is to like, you're a 3D artist? Well, make sure you know how to do this, this, and this too. Otherwise, you can't do your best work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so having a institutional solution to that it appeals to me in a sense, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, but honestly, it also means like, well, then there's a place for me in AAA if I ever want to go that route.
Don't do that, though.
I won't. I promise.
I find this interesting because, like, I would prefer to just specialize in one thing.
Yeah.
I tend, I do multiple things. begrudgingly, because I am an indie developer. But I think that, like, I feel like I'm better. It's easier for me to work on something if I just have one task ahead of me and I don't have to split my brain in between into two different things.
Yeah.
At this new job that I have, like, I am my programmer. And so I've really just been focusing on the programming. But actually, and it's been kind of weird, when there's, like, design implications that I need to do, I'm like, I don't know where to take this direction.
Yeah.
Because I'm not the designer. I shouldn't be the one figuring this out. I should ask for advice. So I take that up in our meetings.
Yeah.
And talk about it from there. Mm-hmm. We don't have a technical designer because we're not AAA. But, like, I think I do tend to sort of fill the role of technical designer in some ways, because I talk with design to figure out how to implement things into the game.
And that's kind of, I mean, essentially that's an endorsement of there being someone else doing that role, mm-hmm. is because you're doing more than you've been hired to do now. Right.
I mean,
which I think we all have. People like you and me have ambitions for that. Right. That doesn't bother us.
Yeah.
But, you know, in terms of it actual, like, at scale,
yeah,
like having a technical designer on that team to consider the design implications and then also be with you on the in the Git repo.
Yeah.
You know, there's utility to that. Right.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, totally. Totally. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, like, it's really
Ellen is not quite there yet.
Well, I personally don't have feelings one way or the other, like, but it seems to me like, I mean, one of the reasons that those kinds of things can happen in organizations is because there's a desire for efficiency or to meet a deadline or something, mm-hmm. Time related, right? And you need to get communication up and running as fast as you can so you can meet that deadline.
Yeah.
Whereas the best thing for the organization long term, holistically, and also for the people and for the product, is to teach people and teach people to communicate and collaborate and give people the time they need to communicate and collaborate.
So what I'm hearing from you is you're saying this is taking responsibilities away from producers.
That actually wasn't the way I was going. No, that's not where I intended to go with it. What I was thinking of is this is a way to continue making people crunch.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Okay.
Which I don't necessarily think I entirely agree with that. You can't see my face, but my eyes are way up in the air. But I don't know. It would be something to explore, I think, systematically. Yeah. You know, we were talking, one of the first things that you mentioned about the indie soapbox was, like, what you see on the surface is not necessarily the whole story.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And this strikes me as something like, okay, this is a cool invention. I could also see how it could become an anti-pattern,
mm-hmm.
you know, where this, instead of improving the way that the teams work together and the way that the organization manages its own work, we'll just hire a technical designer and they'll figure it out.
Yeah.
Anyway, Steven, I don't think you were entirely done with your thought.
No, I'm pretty much done now.
Okay.
No, I'm glad that you brought all of that up, because I think that was very important. And also, I mean, like, what you're saying too kind of does make sense, because, like Mark was saying, technical designers are more prone to burnout.
Yeah.
So maybe there is something to that. I'm not technically a technical designer, so I don't know, but I don't know. I think this, now I want to watch this talk.
Yeah.
That's where I'm at.
Do our press credentials still work?
Hey folks, this is not the first time we've talked about GDC on the program. In fact, if my recollection is correct, we've done this, I think, once a year. Does that sound right?
Yeah, that tracks. Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How often is GDC?
Once a year, I believe.
We've gone to GDC, some or all of us, and we've come back with stories.
Yeah.
And so this format is one we've done before, so we encourage you to check those out in our past episodes archive. Steven, tell us, why is it cool that we have this cool archive? Tell us about it.
Well, I mean, we have a lot of episodes. What episode is this? 228?
228!
So many episodes. Specifically with the GDC episodes, there's a lot of content. We were just saying that there's so many talks, there's so many things that you can watch, and it's hard to keep them all. We kind of disseminate some of the ones that we have talked about in these specials. And so, like, you can get a lot of that insight. And at least we are highlighting some of the ones that, like, might be worth your time to check out. It's all worth your time. I don't know what else to say. Go to nicegames.club to check out our past episodes. Well, Ellen, how many talks did you watch? I know I already teased you, but we already teased you.
I watched zero talks. Yeah, and I don't want to tease you
about it anymore.
No, that's okay.
You can't embarrass Ellen. She's too confident. She's too self-assured. She's very comfortable having biffed on this assignment. You can't make her feel bad. It's impossible.
See, it's not true, Mark. You can be too mean.
Oh, dang.
I'll just go get some ice cream and watch talks and never say anything about my... I'm going to come back here in 2 weeks and be like, guess how many talks I watched in the last 2 weeks.
See, Steven,
sounds like Ellen.
She just picked it right back up.
I love it.
No, but you know what, you guys? I'm going to be like, zero talks.
Zero talks? Oh, no.
You know, one of the fun things... This is a general observation about conferences.
Yeah.
But, you know, you'll go through ahead of time. You're like, I want to watch this one. I want to watch this one. And if you end up... I don't know. Oftentimes, I'll just end up in a random one and be like, this was super interesting.
Yeah. I was going to say that's something that, you know, there's a little bit of an element to that on the online version. But like sometimes when you're just like there in the moment, you're bored and you're in between talks you wanted to watch. Mm-hmm. You just go into a random talk, like you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Then you're like, oh, wow, this is amazing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's you can kind of have that experience because you're just like, GDC is happening. I'm going to go browse the thing and go, oh, wow, there's this talk on spreadsheets.
oh, really?
Oh, yes. but it's not quite the same. So I get it.
I should at some point when I want to add another side project to all my side projects,
yes.
Mm-hmm. Make like a GDC talk randomizer where you just go to a page and you press a button and it just spits out a talk from the YouTube channel.
You know, I was talking to people in a networking group about GDC and about how like I was like, oh yeah, it feels so random. It's just like, you know, pick all the things I like and whatever. And somebody was saying like, oh yeah, but I'm actually in a particular role at my company. I'm looking for very specific talks.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh right. It didn't occur to mm-hmm. me that that's actually a pretty common experience at GDC. And so like we were talking about the YouTube page about how eventually a lot of them end up in there. And so I'm like, they do such a good job of putting many of them for free eventually.
Mm-hmm.
That feels good enough. Like it feels like you know, there's so many and it's great. And then he was saying like, no. Some of the ones I need are not put out there. I'm like, I just look at what's available and look at what is interesting to me because I kind of am interested in everything.
And that makes sense. But I think, I think it makes a lot of sense that people approach it that way. And GDC is kind of built for that because it has mm-hmm. different tracks.
Yeah.
Like I think when I'm there, I'm just walking around and boom, there's a thing and I'll go into it. But like, I think, because this is the reason why they have the different track. They have the design track, the programming track, mm-hmm. the VR track and all that
stuff
because people have specific interests.
Yes.
And they have a little bit of that structure on the YouTube page.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. One thing that, you know, is always that one thing I really appreciate about that, the fact that they do put those episodes out or those we do episodes, they do talks. They put the talks up on the page because like my interests and the things that I want to research change over time. So like there might be a lot of talks about the technical side of the code that I'm just not really interested into right now, but 6 months from now I might need that. So
yeah,
I appreciate that from them. Although, you know, people who are paying all that money to go to the conference they deserve some credit for that too.
Yeah, that's true.
People who've paid all that money.
Mm-hmm. There's at GDC, like the first couple of years I was there, just the absolute, just like terrifying fear of missing out, of like not getting there early enough to not getting into the popular talks, not seeing the one thing, the thing I wanted to see more than anything else.
Yeah.
Like, but then that means I'll miss two things that I really wanted to see.
Yeah.
To see the one thing I desperately want to see.
Yeah.
And like, I've definitely chilled out about that over the years because one, there's ways to see those things now.
Right.
But I also know that I'm not going to look at the vault that often. Like, you know, I know, you know, there's only so much you'll go back to. The experience in the week is actually pretty important.
Yeah.
But like, it's so, I guess I'm like, oh, you know what? I kind of wish I was just like, you know, into one thing and then I could just see all those things. Like I just keep forgetting that that's a pretty common experience is to choose your track, stick to it.
Yeah.
And you know, whereas I'm very much like, I want to see the 101 on a thing I know nothing about. Mm. Like then mm-hmm. I'll get me started on that knowledge or whatever. Or like, I want to see the advanced topic on something that I'm interested in and know a little bit about, but never use in my day-to-day life or work.
Yeah.
I'm desperate to see that. I just have totally, because I never think of it in a career-oriented way, the way you're supposed to.
Well, right? Not necessarily supposed to. You can, I don't know, you can consume GDC content however you want.
Yeah.
I mean, that is true.
But I mean, GDC serves different purposes. I know it's the game developer conference and it is career oriented, but it's also a lot of good content for everybody to look at. So,
Steven.
Yes.
What perspective did you take when you were choosing videos to watch this week?
I took the perspective that I needed to watch some talks for this special.
Excellent.
That feels bad. Yeah. It's not, I mean, like, so I think I've talked about this in previous GGC episodes, but I don't tend to like watching talks because I like lectures and I get bored easy.
Mm-hmm.
I hear you.
It depends on the topics too. Like, actually, the talks that I did watch were interesting and they were good. Like, I was entertained throughout too, partly because, like, one of the things,
was it the dog pictures?
No, there were no dog pictures.
Oh, wow.
Were there any? There were dogs, but there weren't really dog pictures.
What? Okay, tell me more. I'm ready. I'm leaning forward. Well, tell me all about it.
These from their home offices, right?
No, there weren't. Oh, there weren't real dogs. Oh. They were in the game.
Not interested anymore.
But you,
I'm going to close my laptop.
Why don't I just start?
Yeah, go ahead. I'll stop interrupting you.
No, you're fine. I went to the experimental games
workshop.
Yes, thank you, I forgot the last word. I watched that talk. It's like an hour 20 minutes or something like that. So they basically just showed a whole bunch of experimental games that people are working on. I went into it with ambitions, thinking, oh man, these games are going to revolutionize how we look at games in the future and stuff. And I mean, that's really
it's a tall ask.
It's a tall ask and it's a bit naive, but I don't know. I had ambitions, and to be honest, some of those things actually did reach those ambitions.
That's cool.
It was pretty cool. So yeah, I took notes on all the different games I looked at.
Well, I just want to just interrupt you real quick. The experimental design workshop is something that happens at GDC every year.
It does.
And I it's very popular.
Yeah.
And they put out screens in the hallway so people can overflow can see it's that popular in person.
Yeah.
And it's a big hall they put it in.
Yeah.
And because it's just seeing, like, maybe something will be here will be the next hit in 5 years or whatever. Like, but also just people love the content. It's so interesting.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's a bust. And sometimes it's got three earth-shattering concepts.
Yeah.
And I kind of like that about it.
Yeah.
It's very much a grab bag. You don't know. And of course, that's your own assessment, right? Everyone's going to look at these things with their own different lenses. And that's what's so good about it. That's why it endures, I think.
Yeah. Well, and some of these are experimental for different reasons too, because not all of the games are, like, some games are experimental for technical reasons. Some of them are experimental for design reasons.
Yeah, they're pretty broad definition, which is cool.
Quite a few of these broke my brain once or twice. It's pretty fascinating. So the first game that was on this was called Shim. There were like three different
ways.
That's
how you pronounce it?
There were three different ways you could pronounce the name. Like, this was the intro. It's spelled S-C-H-I-M.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, like schism and shim.
I think that was one of the ones, a schism.
Was that the experimental part of this game?
One of the experiments. So you play as like a spirit or a shadow or something. I wasn't exactly clear on how you play it, but like the tech was really cool. You kind of like jump between shadows of different objects. And not just like living objects, but like mailboxes and stuff too.
Oh, fun!
And it was like they displayed a lot of like the technical feat that they were doing. I think this was like a really cool technical thing. It was really fascinating how they did all that stuff. And like, it was basically designed, and it seems like it's going to be a puzzle game. Ooh. There's a game I played a long time ago, not super long ago, but kind of long ago, that was called Contrast.
Yeah, that was like a PS4 launch title, right?
I think it was, it played you played as a character that could walk on shadows and things.
Very cool.
There was a Wii game, like a Hudson Soft Wii game. God, I forget the name of it. That was maybe a couple years earlier than that. That also had a similar premise.
Yeah.
Where you were a shadow and it was a puzzle game.
Yeah.
Which is similar to this game that you're talking about, which I've heard a little bit about.
Mm-hmm.
But it does seem like conceptually, it's not that it's like the newest idea, but like, implementation is an incredible challenge.
Yes. Yeah. It seems like a lot of the puzzles that they displayed in this game are similar to the game or how Contrast worked.
Mm-hmm. Those puzzles. Cool.
So yeah, it's interesting and be worth checking out. All right, next game, Imprint. Oh yeah, you are a hive mind. This is basically how they brought up the Borg mark. I'm sure that you appreciate that.
Cool.
I do.
But basically it's like if you were a hive mind and you like controlled all of these bodies, what would that look like? And it the way that it was kind of like laid out like a narrative, like how they how they went through this like mindset and how they evolved the game concept. Mm-hmm. And it's unclear how the game actually plays because they showed like four different ways that the game was potentially meant to be played.
So is it like there's a bunch of like machine learning agents that you influence rather than a character?
No, you control all of the characters that you activate. Like you start out as one person and then you walk up and you touch a clone of you or something, and then now you're two people.
So it's the Mario Cherry.
Yes, actually, yeah, it's kind of like that. Yeah.
Okay. I'm back in.
But like what happens is like your vision, you see both of those characters, both of their visions. Like through their eyes. So you're walking and you're trying to do that. And I guess if you like stand at a station or a switch and you activate the switch, then that body doesn't move and you can use that to like move around stuff. But eventually you're controlling like four bodies, five bodies and stuff. And it gets really complicated and confusing.
So once you're looking through five viewports, suddenly you can't give all your attention to one. And so your behavior changes.
And it becomes very difficult to determine where you are, where all of your bodies are, where you are.
Oh, interesting.
At the same time. Uh-huh. Like the way that what I really enjoyed about this one was like the way that they described it, their whole mindset. Eventually it became a thing where like, well, now you're a hive mind, but like, you know, as a regular person, you know how to like open doors and stuff. So like as a hive mind, you would know how to open doors too, even if this door has multiple switches that are necessary to open it. So like if you walk up to the door and hit open door, like the rest of your body is just naturally moved to the other switches that require you to open the door sort of thing. It was, it's kind of weird. The whole game, the gameplay like switched between like first person and like top down perspective.
Oh, what's interesting about that example is that, so there's two ways you could approach it. You could say like, how difficult it is for you to try to behave like a hive mind.
Yeah.
Or more narratively, what does it feel like to have a successfully operating hive mind?
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Like that is interesting.
Yeah. It's the whole thing. I'll just check it out.
Yeah. I'm excited for that.
This game was weird.
Wow. Okay.
It was cool. This next game is called Hyper Rogue. You play a roguelike in a hyperbolic plane thing. Hurt my head is the note I took. It did hurt my head because it was like, I don't know, like whenever they moved, everything else moved in a way that I did not understand. It's very mathematically complex, I think.
Right.
And by very mathematically complex, I mean that like computers can do it, but like humans have a hard time perceiving it. So I did. but what was interesting about it was like the design implications of it is because you were in a regular roguelike, like say it's you're just in a square and the enemies chase you and you're surrounded by like two enemies on like the bottom and right of you. Mm-hmm. If you moved up to the right and the enemies moved at the same or at the turn afterwards, they would move and catch up with you.
Yeah.
Immediately. But in this hyperbolic plane thing, if you do the same thing, you move but their movements, for some reason, one of them will move less. And so you can deal with the enemies individually if you move cleverly.
Okay.
I cannot describe it well because I do not understand the math.
So it's like tactics, but on a non-Euclidean plane.
Yes, basically.
I'm watching a video.
That sounds
of it.
Like. So, are you watching it? That now? Totally sounds like my jam.
Yeah. No, it would be. I'm watching a video of it, and it definitely feels like it's doing to my brain the physics of Interstellar, like when Neil deGrasse Tyson tried to explain things that happened in Interstellar. It's like okay. Yeah, my intuition does not work that way.
Yeah, I can't really describe it well enough.
Very cool.
It's definitely worth looking at. I think that the Xenorogue maybe is the developer. Mm-hmm. There were a bunch of other things that they had too. So you know, check that out. The next game I'm talking about is a board game called Chroma. It's spelled KROMA. It's a board game where you create colors using a light source. Like there's like a triangle, and then you like. I think each person is like on a team, like team green or team purple. Mm-hmm. And basically what you want to do is you want to take this, I think it's just a white light source. You want to put pieces on this triangle to get more of your color than anybody else.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And they like describe their whole process and how they designed it actually. And what's kind of interesting about this too is like their process, the way that they described it, is it could only have been made at like the New York Game Center in Academia, because like I think that there was just like a perfect storm of all of these things that led to this game idea.
Very
I don't
cool.
know how. I mean, it sounded accurate when
it was a little presumptuous, but maybe, I'll buy it.
But like, I don't know. I liked how there were two women who had described it, and I liked how these they had described all of the game and stuff. How they it seemed like they had a whole business plan and stuff.
Yeah,
like it felt more developed than a lot of the other games.
I see.
Yeah. So that was cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that one's worth checking out. And I think it was the only board game on display, too, during this thing. I don't know how often they will display board games during the experimental games workshop.
Yeah, I don't. I feel like they have before, but yeah, I don't know. It might just be a matter of like audiences weighted towards video games. So so are the people who submit things.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, that was cool. There was this game called Wide Wide World.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a Dwarf Fortress-esque thing where you... When you change the terrain, it immediately affects all of the AI and stuff, and it's supposed to be an MMO. But like, I guess they have some fancy tech in there to make like all of the changes happen in real time, and they want to expand it to be for like, I don't know, a whole lot of players. Uh-huh. I can't come up with a good number.
All I don't of remember. Mankind.
At least five, like all of mankind.
So the innovation there is concurrency.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, a lot of that is like they said, like the game runs in a browser and like a ton of people could be playing it, and if you make any changes it'll affect everybody like almost instantly.
Yeah. That's like a holy grail MMO
thing. Yeah, like it doesn't have a dedicated server, it uses reflector technology. I'm not that advanced of a programmer to understand any of that, so I had a hard time.
Those are topics where like I feel like I could understand it, I'm just not interested.
Yeah.
Where's our technical designer?
Right. But that was the thing. It was kind of cool though to see it.
Yeah.
The next game I'm bringing up is KU. It's KU. Mm-hmm. This was my favorite game at the top.
Yeah.
But I only put one little sentence of a note. I don't know why I did that. I think
you thought you'd remember it all.
Well, yeah. But also, I think people should just check it out because it's just really cool.
Yeah.
So basically, like you develop your own language, and you can talk to people, using I forgot what the term was. There are like 60. Man, I wish Marth was here. There are like 60 words or ideas that all languages are based around.
Okay.
And so you're able to build a language based off of these ideas and like different and then like you can create words that like, you know, are modifiers to these ideas and such. This language can also be used as a programming language, so you can like program desires. There's like a bunch of people in the world, and you can walk around and talk to them.
Yeah.
You can like program desires that people can have, and they will communicate those desires in the language that you're using to program the game.
Wild.
That's great.
I know. It was so cool.
Oh, that's so perfect, because there's like human readable programming languages, the scripting language exists.
Yes.
So because you're limited to your vocabulary, because you're basically making an invented language, that's such a genius thing to put together. I love it.
I know.
Oh, it's so good.
It was so cool. I was like, oh my God. I had to sit there for a little bit. I was like, dang, this is an amazing game. I got to sit here and take it all in.
Yeah.
It was so cool.
Yeah.
I highly recommend. We'll have a bunch of links to these games because I'm listing off a bunch of games.
Yeah, yeah. Some of the times in this workshop, it'll just be like prototypes no one's seen before.
Right.
But a lot of times there'll be games that are coming out or things that have been written out elsewhere. So we should have public links for most or all of these, right?
Yes. Yeah, I think so. Yep. Mm-hmm. The next game is called Crystalgen.
Mm-hmm.
I'm mispronouncing that. I think I'm sorry. We'll have the link in there. It's a game that is like where like everything is portrayed through flashes. You know those scenes in movies where like people are at a rave or something and the lights are flashing and like you just see like you'll see like flashes of people moving and you can like perceive them moving, but you don't actually see the motion in between it.
Strobe motion.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So this game was kind of based around that. There was a lot of flashing lights and kind of gave me a headache because when lights flash like that, it gives me a headache. But like I thought it was really interesting. I was also like while I was watching, I was very unnerved because I thought that like something was going to pop up. I don't think that that's just the case with this game, but I think the whole game is complete and you can check it out because it's on, I think it's on Itch and Steam. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's a game to check out. And then my next one is, I just put in a little phrase here. Oh Lord, Blazeball is in this. Blazeball is in this.
Yeah.
So now I understand actually how Blazeball works. I put a note in here. You just log into a website, bet on games, and vote on stuff sometimes. That's the game.
Yeah.
That's it.
That's actually one of the innovations of BlazBall is that it's not a complicated experience.
Yeah, yeah.
It's everything about it. It's is the narrative stuff around it.
Yeah. It's the narrative and stuff. It's like the narrative, but is it mostly needs absurdist.
That mechanical core to support the rest of that nonsense.
Yeah,
You can't build a fantasy of it all with no gameplay.
Yeah,
but you can build it with extremely little gameplay.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and that's why I think that's why a lot of people have a hard time explaining the game is because like people want to talk about the narrative and the things that happened in the game, but they don't want to talk about how the game works because it's not as interesting, intentionally not as interesting.
Yeah.
So now
it's when people describe like French fries as a ketchup delivery mechanism.
Yeah.
It's a similar metaphor here. It's like the gameplay is just there to deliver the rest of it.
Yes.
That's what's valuable. That's what's important.
Yeah.
A more complicated set of rules, a more interesting game would actually probably make it worse.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yes, exactly.
Maybe.
Well, potentially.
Well, I'm just thinking, like, if you really boil it down to brass tacks, the way that you describe a lot of games might sound boring. Well, you press this button, and then you press this button, and if you press this button, this button, this button, you can progress.
I hope listeners were taking notes.
Yeah. I mean, that's true though. Actually, what was interesting about this is that like they were describing like a lot of, I think these two were narrative designers, and they were describing a lot of design that went into the things that happened.
Very cool.
So yeah, it was really interesting.
Yeah.
I was, when I saw it first, I was like, oh no.
and then you developed appreciation for it.
Yes. I'm not going to watch it. I'm not going to pay or participate in it, but I'm glad that they have it. Also, there's BlazBall recaps. They have like official ones. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I don't think when people describe the game to you, they want to describe it to them themselves. So I've never heard of a recap, but I'm sure it exists.
Yeah.
The next game is I think this is a French name, sort of. It's like Love Sphinx. I cannot pronounce it. I'm sorry. It is a puzzle game where you use a xylophone to discover a language. Basically, like the game was like there was like a xylophone, and it had a microphone next to it, and it would pick up all the noises from the xylophone.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a cube that had a bunch of symbols that kind of looked like a maze, but it wasn't exactly a maze. And you would use the xylophone to light up different things on the cube, and you're trying to figure out what all of these things mean.
Ooh.
Apparently it's based
on Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Exactly.
How neat.
It's based on that scene. They literally had that.
Yeah.
They had that in the little video they had.
I love
bom,
it.
Bom.
Yeah. And they had a version that was, because like I think they were developing this during pandemic stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They had a version that worked with any instrument. They had some footage where like people were solving the puzzle with a guitar, like doing it online, and like the cube was in a different room.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah,
that's cool.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. This next game is called AI Dungeon. There are a lot of games in here, y'all. This next game is called AI Dungeon.
Mm-hmm.
It's an actual procedurally generated text-based adventure game.
Mm-hmm. Whoa.
All of the text is AI generated, like players or developers.
Yeah, we're about ready for that now, aren't we?
Yeah. I put in here, this game is how you get to the singularity, dot.
Okay. So when you describe that, I'm thinking like the RPG version of Blue Jeans and Bloody Tears, but you guys know what I'm talking about?
No.
Okay, well, it's like it's an AI generated song. Well, I think that
you brought this up before. I do remember this.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's like the lyrics were developed by an AI after they plugged in all the winners from Eurovision back 20 years or whatever.
And then they
put it to music.
Yes.
And the refrain is Blue Jeans and Bloody Tears.
Yeah.
Which is amazing.
It's such an Eastern European song.
So this game has those elements, but like this is like, well, if you read the text is like, it seems like somebody actually, like a human actually wrote it.
Yeah, it makes sense.
That's why I'm concerned about the singularity.
Gotcha.
Yeah, no, it was really cool though. Like you would put in a sentence that like is an actual, you know how like a lot of these text-based adventure games work is like you put in a specific set of directions so the computer can parse that into inputs, and then you'll go through a particular you'll go through a different branch in the narrative of the game. This game, you type in a sentence saying like, I want to learn how to read other people's minds, and the game will be like, oh, okay, well, here's this book. You start reading the book, and the book gives you examples of things that you can do. Like, it'll describe all of that stuff.
So like, it's text generation narrative, but also it understands that the input is a player who wants to do things.
Yes.
And then so that's interesting.
Yeah.
That's really, really cool.
Yeah, yeah. And they said, I don't know how true this is, but they said that games or gameplay that people experience, narratives that people experience, are things that no one else has experienced before.
Right.
So, yeah, it's really cool.
Man, I like what kind of, I mean, is it, if it just accepts input and just gives you some results and then just can do that forever.
Yeah.
That would be kind of be enough for a full on experience. But I wonder how easy it would be to add stuff to it.
Yeah.
Like, could you keep track of an inventory? Could you have, you know, like narrative callbacks? Could you, you know, have a could it be structured in advance to make sure that it follows a plot arc? Mm-hmm. You know, like how much could you feed the parameters of the generator without breaking it?
Yeah.
Or without making it too cookie cutter?
Yeah.
Right. Oh, that's interesting.
Bunch of different ways that, yeah, that game could go. Yeah, it was really cool too. Mm-hmm. And then I think this is the last game. It's Despelote.
Mm-hmm.
It's a game about it's a story about like a child growing up watching and playing soccer in Ecuador.
Yeah.
But like things are happening in the background. So like I think you the footage that they started with was like you're in school and you're just like, you know, the teacher's teaching, but you're not paying attention to that. You're looking at people playing soccer outside.
Right.
And then like you go outside and you play soccer with people, but like you can, as like the ball goes somewhere, it'll roll and then you'll like walk over there and like there'll be a conversation happening in the background and stuff. The art style was really cool in this game. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed it. It's like you're like 2D. It's like 2D images and then like you're walking around in a 3D space.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't think I'm going to do justice describing it.
Yeah.
You should check it out.
So it's like the narrative is that you're sort of caught up with your own thing, but then there's like the world around you is sort of the thing outside your vision.
Yeah.
Is where the story is being told.
Yeah. The developer was the one describing it, and they were, the way that they were describing it is like they wanted you to feel like, you know, you were caught up doing something, focusing on soccer or focusing mm-hmm. on stuff that's happening in your life where all these other things are happening. They described in, I believe it was a Mexican movie mm-hmm. that came out where like there's these two teenagers going on a road trip somewhere. And then they'll have like road trip adventures. But like in between all of that, they will be like, it'll like cut from that and go into like what's actually happening around them that like they're not paying attention to.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sometimes it's like somber stuff. I'll have to look at the movie. I look up the movie for that because it was cool.
Yeah. Well, like famously, it's a kind of narrative that I think is really effective and not used well enough.
Mm-hmm.
Like, isn't like The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly? Like, it's about Clint Eastwood's nameless guy, but in the background is the Civil War. And and that's where all the impact of the movie is, not in the character's journey, which is essentially very light.
Yeah.
There's also like This War of Mine is a game that's sort of like that. And I feel like the I would love that kind of more mature storytelling where we take our protagonists away from being like the most important characters in the worlds that we build.
Yeah.
I think of like, man, what would Mass Effect be like if you weren't Shepard? Like you could still make a really compelling, thrilling gameplay with that happening around you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You don't have to be the one that is the most important.
Yeah. Right? I've always wanted a really well done like movie or show or TV show or movie or something where like, you know, you're just a citizen in Metropolis or whatever. And Superman's having a giant battle in the background or something.
Yeah.
You're like, dang, it's happening again. Yeah. They had a movie like, or a TV show like that, but it got canceled.
Yeah. I don't know what you're talking about. Yeah. Well, that's an opportunity for irony or comedy, but I feel like it could be used better.
Yeah.
Or you know, that's actually good. I think people should be doing more of that too. Mm-hmm. But I think more having something where it's you just a place, you have a place in the world.
Yes.
You're not the one guiding the world.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. I agree. Yeah. I agree. That would be very fascinating too. I mm-hmm. like that. Yeah. I think that was the last one. And I did watch another talk. I don't know how long I've been going for. How long have I been talking?
For quite a while, but we got time.
Okay. Cool. Yeah, I watched another talk. It was all about spreadsheets, as I alluded to earlier.
Uh-huh. Dun, da, da.
It's what listeners have been waiting for all episode.
Yes.
Barely.
I have a hard time listening to talks. I get bored.
Yep.
But the one I was really jazzed about was the one about spreadsheets.
I mean, I got bored during this talk, too. I'm not going to lie.
Okay.
it wasn't that long. It was only 30 minutes, but it's a lot of talk.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I kind of just took notes on random things on there. The person who did the talk, they had this link. We'll put it in the show notes again. It disseminates all of this information so everybody can check it out.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the stuff that they talked about with respect to the spreadsheets and stuff, I kind of knew. I knew what a filter was. I don't use those enough though when I'm making a spreadsheet, so that was neat. Brought up pivot tables. I don't know what that is. There's like this, like it was like beyond the scope of the talk. I don't know.
That's pretty advanced.
Is it?
I don't use pivot tables.
Okay, yeah. It seems like a thing, like it seemed like people who use pivot tables already know how to use pivot tables. People who are interested in pivot tables know enough about pivot tables to not want to be interested about it in the talk. And I was like, I don't even know what this is.
Isn't that, yeah, so, I don't know either, but I think it's that's where you start to be like, you might as well just be running a database. Like
maybe, right, yeah.
Once you get to that level.
Okay, sure.
We all sound very hilarious right now. Like, what is that?
Well, it's, the tough thing is from a learning perspective,
yeah.
It is difficult to learn about something if you don't know why you would, like how it relates to you. You
yeah,
know what I mean?
Yeah, it doesn't solve an immediate problem you have.
Right, so if you had a problem or if you were given a problem that you needed to solve and the best solution was a pivot table, that would help it stick.
Yeah. They brought up drop downs, which I learned about when we were doing Robust and then Ellen. Uh-huh. They said negative things about drop downs. I didn't understand that.
What kind of negative things did they
say? It was just
Ellen, hold back. She's getting in her fighting stance.
it was vague. It was like, oh no, people are, you know, people in the chat are going, oh, drop downs are terrible, but here are the benefits of drop downs. And I was like, why are drop downs terrible? They didn't describe that in the talk.
I would venture that it's because both Google Sheets and Excel have autocomplete for things you've entered already.
Oh.
So it might just be like a waste of time. Like you might, like if you need to fill in something you filled in before, just type the first letter and you're going to get that as a suggestion. But I don't know. I mean, that's a potential argument. I don't know that I would make that argument.
Yeah, I don't know. Like I said, they didn't make an argument.
It depends on why you're using the spreadsheet.
It requires you maintain a separate data somewhere else. Yeah. But then you can they seem great. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
It depends on why you're using it.
It depends on why you're using it.
It depends.
It always does.
Yeah.
There was also this tool that they used to export like sheet data, and there was a link for that on there too that I took a note on.
Mm-hmm.
Also, you can make buttons in Google Sheets. I didn't know that. Apparently, by coding in JavaScript, you can make a fancy button for things.
Oh well, never mind then.
Yeah, that's how I felt too. I was like, I don't want to learn.
And then they'll run, you know, macros or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, and you can, yeah, like I think they made a button so that you can export the sheet data, and I think that's what this link is supposed to help.
That,
you with.
It does sound very useful.
It does, yeah. But I
did they talk about? Did they talk about how Google Sheets can do those sick checkboxes?
They did.
Yeah.
Yeah, actually, they went over all the different strengths and weaknesses of not just Excel and Google Sheets, but other different spreadsheet technology.
So yeah. Are there others that are just sort of competing with those two big heavy hitters? Or are there ones that are like specific for certain tasks?
I assume they're they had like a little thing on the, I didn't get a chance to read it, but they had a thing on the bottom that said the benefits of these specifically, but they had like a table. Like, does this have this feature? Yes or no? Most of the things had the features that all the other ones had, except for like cloud saving and stuff.
Right.
And that you don't always need cloud saving. So, but like even then, like only a couple of them, like only a couple of the features were not featured in everything else. So it kind of feels like you could just use anything. And almost all of the things in that talk applies to all of the other spreadsheet things that you could use.
Sure.
So,
cool.
Yeah. I realized I didn't take that many notes on this talk.
It just went right into your brain.
Yep.
You just absorbed it all.
Clearly, and that's why I'm talking about it now.
The context of like, I mean, I think as a game designer, you're like, oh, of course you have a spreadsheet talk at the Game Developers Conference.
Yeah.
But like, that's not always immediately obvious.
Yeah.
Right? Like what you'd use them for.
Well, they did actually go over like, they had like a list of people who had said why I use or what I love about spreadsheets and stuff. But there are a couple of people who are in that thing who were like, I have to use spreadsheets begrudgingly, and they have some benefits, but there are also a lot of negative things about it.
Yeah.
Like one person was like, I have to keep updating the spreadsheet and I'm sick of, and I don't like having to, you know, remember to update the spreadsheet for me
right.
in order for it to be useful. You know, that's a fair criticism.
Mm-hmm.
There are ways to automate some of that stuff, but that doesn't work for everything.
Yeah.
Like that kind of stuff makes things kind of difficult.
Yeah. I'm waiting for a spreadsheet tool that lets you put in arbitrary data, and then while you're editing it, reformats. Like I have a column, and every cell in this column is three paragraphs of text.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want the rows to be very tall. And I don't want to have, I don't need to read them in that way. I want to be able, but when I want to edit them, I want a nice editing experience. I think in localization, this is a problem where people who do narrative design in spreadsheets, the editing experience is very frustrating. Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you're not editing essentially strictly, you know, small scale bits of data.
Yeah.
I'm like waiting for innovation in that space to like have a better experience, to be more database like and more multiple views, yeah. You know, because it's
possible that some of these spreadsheet texts that I had never heard of that you could use for maybe they
Where's
have
my three dimensional spreadsheet? That's, I'm like not even joking. Like
spreadsheets.
The RPG AI is working on it.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so that's basically everything, right, Stephen?
I mean, yeah, that was all of the
talks. It's all the talks that I saw, all the ones you saw, all the ones Ellen saw.
There were only five talks.
No.
There were a lot of things, and actually there were a lot of things that were made by local developers, too, that we didn't cover. Maybe we'll put some links in there.
Yeah, you know, there's of the people who've been guests on this show, like they're well represented at GDC this year, which is pretty cool.
Hooray!
Yeah, so lots of friends of the program, and we'll put the links to the talks that we talked about in these show notes, and then some general links to like GDC's YouTube page and where you can find more information about all of a lot of the stuff.
Yeah.
And again, if you're listening to this from well into the future, you know, hopefully a lot of this year's talks will be on their YouTube page as well by now. And we'll have more thoughts on GDC, I guess, next year.
Yes.
And probably a little in the meantime.
Yes.
2 weeks or like 2 months from now, Ellen comes in. I watched the talks, you guys. Let's do it.
I'm sort of tempted to like, there's so much and it's all available to us.
Yeah.
Like, we can do a part.
We could just do this again. We could like have content for months.
Yeah.
Just doing a couple of these talks.
Yeah.
You know, every time.
Yeah.
Listeners, let us know.
Yes. Use the feedback form.
Mm-hmm.
You know where to find it.
NiceGames.club/feedback.
Steven, they know where to find it.
But
you don't have to say
NiceGames.club/feedback.
They understand. They don't need to feel like they're talked down.
NiceGames.club/feedback.
That's our show. Check out our website, NiceGames.club, for all the show notes and links to resources that Mark just mentioned. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode and whether we should do a part two and on our programming in general. Go to nicegames.club/feedback, just like Steven said, and tell us what you think. You can also get in touch with us on Twitter at nicegamesclub, where Dale tweets about game dev resources and where should we begin a game of stories. Or you can email us through contact@nicegames.club. Want to support the show? There are so many ways. Give us a review on your favorite podcast app. Tell your friends about your favorite episodes. Join us on Discord by visiting nicegames.club/discord. And we're on Patreon. As a patron of the show, you'll enjoy bonus content, extra jokes, and more. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub.
So until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice. I have an easy ball and low ball. Easy. I have an easy question for you, Stephen, which I promised you before we started.
Thank you.
Hard questions for Mark today. Easy questions for Stephen.
Yay!
When you say in the game Shim,
yes,
or Shkizism,
one of them names
that they're walking around in shadows.
Yes,
is that shadows spelled with S C H?
S no, no, it is not.
Okay,
just regular shadows.
Okay,
yeah, like your hand.
No, because like the title of the game.
Yeah, I got it.
We can cut that part.
No.
Cool.
They're not that clever.
Next talk.